Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Standard Podcast. Our guest today is Safdar Alam, who is Chief Executive Officer at UK-based Maidan Capital and the former Global Head of Islamic Structuring at JP Morgan. Safdar's website, safdaralam.co.uk, hosts a variety of information and training courses about finance and trading, and he is known for his views that most Islamic finance today simply mimics conventional finance and that the industry is in need of radical reform. Safdar, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks, Dave.
So what I wanted to discuss with you is your view on Islamic finance, which is not a very conventional view, but I find it to be very interesting and quite compelling, and then eventually leading on to Bitcoin. But before we get into all of that, could you tell us a little bit about you and your own background in finance and how you got to where you are?
Okay, so when I'd finished university and then I was 21 or so, and really my main aim at the time was just to make as much money as I possibly could. And so I moved into investment banking, working in London, and I went through various roles in investment banking, mainly working on the trading floor. I got involved with structuring and pricing derivatives, exotics on the trading floor. And my main experience at that time was with UBS. And after a few years of that, even though the money was quite good, of course, but I got a little bit bored of the whole thing. And I think also probably I became a bit less materialistic. I began to think more about things, I guess maybe more ethical things. And also personally, I became a bit more aware of my own religion and how I figure in the scheme of things. And then I found out that a lot of what I'd been doing was not aligned with the ethics in my religion. It was classified as haram, the aspect of gambling, speculation, you know, just using money and securities to make more money. And also working in a banking institution where even though my role was on the trading side, but the main work that the banks do, how they survive and make money is through lending and interest. And that act as well is prohibited in our religion, in Islam. So I became very aware of these things and I wanted to move away from banking. At that time also, I became aware that there was such a thing as Islamic banking. So this was in the late 90s. It was a very new thing in the UK, very niche. And I started to research it. And then I decided that, you know, I thought it was opportune for me to try to keep to my specialization of money and finance, but try to move to Islamic finance, Islamic banking, and see if I could combine the two, as it were. You know, my knowledge of finance and banking, and also trying to work in a field that's more aligned to my values as well. And after it took about a good 2 years of trying, I finally managed to get a role in Islamic banking. And then I've stayed in Islamic banking and Islamic finance since then. About after 12 years of working in Islamic finance, I decided to leave the industry of Islamic banking specifically, because I was very disillusioned by how it operates and the ethics it holds. Because for me, I'd gone a full 180, right? I was very materialistic through. At the end, for whatever reason, but I felt quite driven by moral values at the end. And so interestingly, the same moral values that drove me to focus on Islamic finance, those same values led me to leave the Islamic banking industry. And I've done a few things since then, but the main thing I'm focusing on the last few years is with the emergence of fintech. I think there's a very good opportunity to continue to be active in the finance world and investment world, but yet find a way that I think is more aligned to what we are told as Muslims of what we should do with money and investment. So it's almost like trying to carve a parallel way forward for Muslims that's different to the elephant in the room, which is the Islamic banking side of Islamic finance.
Yeah. And so, to begin with, let's begin a little bit with a kind of broad overview of what you mean by Islamic finance. And I mean specifically, you know, the actual principles of Islamic finance as you understand them and as you think they should be practiced, not so much how they are practiced. We'll compare to that in a bit. But what is, you know, for many people who are listening here, I presume just the entire idea of Islamic finance seems like an alien concept. Why should a religion have its own financial system? So could you give us a little bit of your idea about what is the core of Islamic finance? How it differs from the mainstream fiat finance?
Okay. I guess one way of approaching it is to say that in Islam, we are told our approach to money and finance, it's not distinguishable to our approach in everything else, which means that it must be driven by values that we are informed that are important. And so this broadly, this relates to ethics. So in the sense that, you know, there's different classification of rules in Islam. One is our relationship with our creator, for example, how we worship. And we're told how that should be because we shouldn't transgress beyond certain bounds. And also we're told how to deal with people. You know, not all things are legal rules, but we're told, you know, not to lie with people. If you give your word, you should hold on to it. And also, we're told less legal issues as well. We're told how to interact with our parents, for example. We're told how to interact with our children. And so, these are all different aspects of rules. And the same applies to money and finance. We're told how we should interact with money, how we should interact with people when it comes to money, and how we should handle ourselves when it comes to transactions. And so initially, a lot of these rules are kind of prescriptive. It tells us, you know, you should do this, 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 or you should not do this, this, this. And often what's told to us it's quite simple things, you know, especially when it comes to finance, because remember, these rules were revealed to us for, either in the Quran itself or early on at the time of the Prophet, peace be upon him, which was in the 7th century. So the way the rules presented to us are consistent with that time. For example, we're not told about how to invest in financial markets. We're not told about how to deal with institutional activities that might not be socially responsible or consistent with the environment. But we're given basic principles. We're told, and so the main principles, I think one that most people would know if they're familiar with Islamic finance, one is there's a prohibition of lending with interest. We are allowed to lend money and incur debt, but nobody's allowed to benefit from it. So you must repay only the principal. And so lending at interest is forbidden in the strongest terms. But there are many other aspects of business that we're told to avoid or to do so. And they're quite simple things, to be honest. We're told not to lie and not to deceive each other, to be honest in our dealings. And interestingly, we are told about certain transactions. And when these examples are given, these often... what's involved, the commodities involved are often gold and silver, because this was money at the time. But also examples are given referring to dates and wheat. And we're told some certain kinds of transactions are not permissible and some are. So we're also told, for example, speculation is not permissible. You shouldn't speculate with your money. We're told gambling is not permissible. And so from these very, very simple rules, I would say, it gives us the framework to develop more complex principles. And I think that's broadly where we're coming from, is that Islam sets down for us a certain set of principles, which should be our starting point. And from there, we can derive economic systems.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifeddin.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last with an ice colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Okay, so to get into a little bit more detail, what is the rationale behind behind forbidding lending at interest?
Okay, so in the specific scenario that the revelations occurred in the Quran, there was a specific form of lending that occurred during amongst the tribes in that part of Arabia at the time, and this was customary. It was custom. So what used to happen was one person with capital would lend money to somebody who needs money, and the terms would be very simple, such as, you will repay me after a period of time, perhaps 1 year, and you will repay me twice the principal. You'll repay me double. And it was simple as that. There was no real need for any further negotiation. And at that time of repayment, if you're unable to settle, the lender would go, fine, you have another 1 year now, but the amount is doubled again. And it will literally be doubled every year. And as you know, as we can imagine, if you're not going to repay early, you're not going to be able to repay 4 times, 8 times, 16 times. So what would happen is very quickly, this would result in financial slavery, because that's the final outcome. You and your family would be financial slaves of the lender. So this was customary at the time. And this was a trigger for a revelation in the Quran to forbid this practice. And the one thing that really drew me to Islamic finance and the whole idea of morals as well, was that the punishment for this activity, for this lending, we are told the punishment, if you do this, the punishment is God and his messenger will declare war on you. Now, this punishment is, it's incredibly specific, and it's a punishment not given to any other sin in our religion.
Yeah, I'm kind of trying to get more at the, not so much the circumstantial reasons for why this happened, in as much as it is the economic rationale. Why is it wrong to charge an interest on a loan? So if you want to lend money to somebody, they want to pay you 5%. They want to do it, you want to do it. Why should it be forbidden? Could you make a case for that?
Okay, so I think if we look at two isolated parties looking to make a transaction, and one wants a loan, the other one has the capital willing to give a loan, and if we look at the fact that they mutually agree, then it can be argued that that transaction on its own, you can argue that that might not be delivering harm to anybody, especially if the repayment is within the capacity of the borrower and he repays. Then, you know, the transaction's finished. And I agree, on that isolated incident, it's difficult to evidence harm, any harm that might occur. So, but we have to remember that when we humans are in situations that we don't often stick to the rules. So for example, so the point I'm making is that we have to look at the potential harm that can occur, and we also have to consider human nature. So for example, one of the reasons that alcohol is made forbidden is that even though very small amounts of it might not intoxicate, but larger amounts can. And so there's a principle that we derive from there, that if there's an activity which extended use of that activity can result in harm, that's quite possible, even though single isolated activities might not result in harm. So I think this comes back to the understanding of human nature as well, that if we are permitted down a slippery slope of making a single transaction where we can charge interest, that the risk lies that this can then become systemic and become systematic. And I think that's kind of where we are today. And I think it's much easier today to evidence the harm that's created by a system that's built on lending and interest.
Yeah, I tend to think, when I try and think about the rationale for this being a bad thing, I think of it in terms of, as we see it in the current fiat system, when a lender has the ability to lend out at interest, they effectively have the ability of increasing the money supply without actually making new gold coins or printing new paper money. So when banks lend in the fiat monetary system, that creates new money supply, because they issue loans that are not necessarily, or that are mostly not backed by any kind of collateral on hand. So they're overextended financially. And I think the way that I like to think about it is that in this kind of situation, when a person is able to lend at a fixed interest rate, their fallback position is that they're going to take away the property of the borrower in case the borrower is unable to pay back. Now, yes, you can say that this is, if the borrower and the lender agree, then why should anybody be, why should anybody intervene? And I understand that, but I think, you know, from the religious perspective, which looks more at the social implications of something like this, I think the case against it is that even though the two of them are able to agree, if the reason they agree is that we as a society normalize the idea of the borrower taking the lender taking the borrower's stuff, which effectively monetizes their collateral, so that the house is basically the collateral, but since the house is with the borrower, it's not with the lender, it's being used as a consumer good. You know, the person is living on it, and at the same time, it's being used as a monetary good that the bank will liquidate it if the loan cannot be paid. So I I mean, this is kind of obviously colored by my Austrian inflationist perspective, but it disagrees with the way that the Austrians think about it. But if I were to make the case for why this is wrong, I think it's inflationary. I think that is creating new money that makes us as a society live in a situation where new money is being created by these financial institutions that can then impound the property of people who aren't able to pay. And so the case against it is that people shouldn't, I guess the religious case against it is that as an individual, you don't want to be living in a society that accepts those things. What do you think of that kind of take on it?
So, I mean, I certainly do agree with that and the consequence of money creation and credit creation. But equally, if I look at it now from a religious point of view, as I understand it, the concept of credit creation, in fact, the only currencies that were documented at the time in that region were gold and silver. And perhaps it was also recognized as some form of dates and wheat and so on could be used as currency. But there was no form of paper currency in circulation in that region at that time, as I understand it. And it's not documented as such. So when you're talking about the consequence of credit creation linked to lending, I think so from our religion, it's not referring to that. So even though I think we can extrapolate it to identify the harm from that, but for us to say that harm only exists when it comes to credit creation, that would not be consistent with our religion. It's our religion's giving that prohibition, even with gold, even with solid gold. And so I think from that angle, so something that you did touch upon, when two individuals do a transaction, if it's lending, now they don't begin from an equal standing, right? Even though the contract is mutual. But if you're lending gold or physical money, for example, the key difference is that one has the money and one does not. So there's, from the beginning, there's an automatic imbalance in the position of the parties. And this imbalance, I think, is materialized in precisely how you explained. So one has a claim on the wealth of the other. So either that's through repayments of gold, or if that fails, then there'll be some form of collateral or route to compensation. And that will be the wealth of the borrower. It could be his house, his property, but there's some claim on that property. So I think it is linked to what you said, but my response to that would be that the damage, I think, is also visible even when sound money is used for lending.
Yeah, I'll clarify. I'll say, even in a gold standard, I think what happens is that the way that I think about it is that if you're doing interest-based lending, let's say you're the lender. You have a certain amount of money that you've handed out to the borrower, and they're going to be investing it in some business, let's say, and you have their house as a collateral. In this situation, you are treating the collateral, which is a consumer good that his family lives in, as an asset on your balance sheet that you can use as a liquid asset. So for me, even though no gold is being printed, effectively you've monetized the house by making it the collateral for the loan. And that's the tricky part. And I think perhaps my case against interest, why I think, and this is something, that's still very raw in my mind, so I could be completely hallucinating nonsense here, so and please correct me if that's the case. But the way that I think about it is that, what determines interest rates from the Austrian perspective is time preference. So the lower people's time preference, the more they think about the future, the more they're able to delay gratification, the more they're able to save some of their resources from consumption. And that act of saving is what creates resources that are available for capital investment, which then, the more that happens, the lower the price of capital. So the Austrian theory of interest rate is that it's time preference that determines the interest rate. And if we look at it historically, we see that the interest rate has been declining throughout history generally. I mean, it goes up and down in general, but I think there's still a long-term decline in interest rates that at the turn of the 19th, at the end of the 19th century, at the turn of the 20th century, the lowest interest rate you could get was around 2%. So we'd already, under the gold standard, when saving became extremely efficient because gold was available worldwide and everybody could use the same currency, and the whole world was on the gold standard, and saving in gold was extremely efficient as a way of saving money into the future. Savings increased to the point where the price of interest was only about 2% per year. And I think, you know, perhaps a century later, if we didn't have World War I, and if we continued on the gold standard, hypothetically, imagine a world in which, you know, we just continue to have another, if we had another 110 years, similar to the era between 1870 and 1914 on a gold standard, where all over the world, living standards were improving and saving rates were rising and interest rates were declining. Extrapolate that for another 110 years. You know, if we go from 40-year golden era to 150-year golden era, and I can see that in this kind of world, what happens is that capital becomes so abundant, the interest rate declines, that at some point, the idea of lending with interest on its own on the market disappears. That it's not something that would exist on a free market if people could just save enough and accumulate enough capital. Because at that point, you know, once the market interest rate is something like close, very close to 0%, and this is, doesn't apply to the current 0% interest rate regime, which is imposed by inflationary central bank. But imagine a 0% interest rate or close to 0% interest rate in a world of hard money. In that kind of world, people are saving a lot. There's an abundance of capital. If you're going to be if you're going to be lending to somebody, why would you want to take on the risk if the return is extremely low? And so in my mind, lending in that kind of world would tend toward equity investment instead. We'd have the lower interest rates go and the more abundant capital, the more that the lenders can just take equity rather than lend. Because ultimately, I think the real problem here is in that when you are lending at interest, you're making a promise that you cannot keep. That's really the that you can't guarantee that you keep. So when banks are lending to people and telling people we're going to give you a 5% return guaranteed, there's no such thing as a guaranteed return, because whatever it is that you're investing your money in, it can fail and it can go to zero. So I think to go back to the original point we were discussing on the problem with lending, I think this is another way of explaining it, that the only reason we can have interest rate lending is because we have the fallback option of impounding another person's property. But that disappears in a world in which we have this asymmetry where people are where people put their money in the bank and they expect to get a 5% regardless of what the bank does. How is the bank able to guarantee them that 5%? It's because it can engage in inflation in one way or the other. And I think this is where I go perhaps more Austrian than the Austrians, in that I think it's not just fractional reserve banking that leads to the business cycle and inflation. I think you could well argue that interest rate lending in overall does something similar, because it there's no way of meeting these kind of, you know, you're guaranteed a 5% return. There's no way of meeting that unless you have somebody with a money printer behind you who's able to print money, or unless you're able to impound other people's property and then leave people homeless. And so I guess the kind of really controversial thing that I'm trying to arrive at here is that there might be a case to be made that interest is a phenomena that exists when time preference is very high, that you don't even really need a religious ban on it for it to disappear, that in a free market with enough capital accumulated, you would just witness interest disappear. Because then with you know, you're taking on the risk if you're lending to somebody at a very low interest rate, when time preference drops and interest rate drops, you're taking on the risk of not having a return on your capital, because the business could always go to zero. Anything can always go to zero. You know, you never know what happens in this world. There's always that fundamental risk. And so you're taking on that risk of going to zero and you're getting a fixed return. Why would you want that? If you're taking on the downside risk all the way down to zero, you want the upside risk all the way. And I think with an increase in capital and a decline in time preference, we might end up in this kind of world. But who knows? What do you think?
You know, it's interesting to listen how you think and your mind works. And so a few things that you said in terms of where we're starting from and where you envisage that we would end up if we had sad money, I see many parallels with how I think and what I've discovered. So in the context of religion. So for example, you know, we have this thing called zakat, where you have to, it's like a tax on wealth, where roughly you pay around 2.5% of your wealth as tax every year. And so we have this situation that, so let's assume, so as Muslims, we're not allowed to lend money, but we have capital, we have wealth, and it's being taxed every year, 2.5%. So effectively, our capital is being reduced. If we do nothing with it, it's being reduced every year. So my interpretation of that, because I think this is how our religion works, that we're told certain things, but hidden behind them are certain messages. So when we're told that our capital is being reduced 2.5% every year, we are being told to be active with our capital. Right. We're being told that if you want to keep your capital level, you've got to do something with it so you earn more than the tax that you're paying. So we are being told to use our capital and earn some profits. Now, if we cannot lend and earn interest, which we're not allowed to, then the only way to earn profits is to be utilizing it in some enterprise or venture where potentially some profits are returned. And this ties in similarly to the conclusion that you had, where you have to invest in some kind of equity type projects or equity type returns. And I think these are the kinds of messages that Muslims are being told behind the primary layer of prohibitions and information that we're presented with.
Yeah. Okay. So these are the kind of broad strokes, as we said, you know, no lending, no speculation, and no gambling. These are the broad strokes of what Islamic finance stands for. Now, what does the Islamic finance industry do today, and how is that different, and why do you think it's basically all fiat, to use our favorite adjective in this podcast, derogatory adjective?
So I would say, in terms of my own familiarity with fiat and use of fiat, it's probably only risen in the last few years. So my analysis and understanding of the Islamic banking industry developed in parallel alongside that. So then when I later on began to understand the implications of fiat, then I saw a very close connection. But my understanding developed without really knowing what fiat was. So Islamic finance, as it's practiced today, it's reasonably significant. It's still niche. But the way it's practiced today is that, so if we look at the asset allocation, it's not easy to find, but there are some analyses that tell us the activities in the global Islamic finance sector. And about 75% of global assets in this sector are Islamic banking assets, it's Islamic banks. About 20% are in the Sukuk market. And Sukuk is equivalent of the debt capital markets, it's Islamic version of bonds. So those two combined make up 95% of all the assets in the Islamic finance sector globally. That leaves 5%. And to me, that 5% is the interesting one. So that 5% is some of it's Islamic insurance called takaful, and the rest of it is in funds and investment. Okay. And that, so the funds and investment maybe is 3% of our market. So the market size, very difficult to estimate, but the global market is estimated around about $3 trillion today. 75% of that is banking assets. And you, as you will know, when banks have assets, these are largely loans on its balance sheet. 20% in debt capital markets, which are bonds, which are interest-bearing instruments, but there are ways to make them Islamic. So my contention and my problem with Islamic finance is that the way we have chosen to implement it, we've chosen to implement it in a way such that 95% of our activity, 95% of our assets are debt and interest related. And for me, that's a real problem, because the interesting thing, what we should be doing is in that 5%.
Yeah. So, and I was looking at the analysis that you have on your website of a particular Malaysian bank, which you don't name. And you go through their balance sheet and you find that essentially, 97% of all their assets and 99% of their liabilities are all interest-bearing products. And they bear the same interest that you find on the Malaysian capital markets that aren't supposedly not Islamic, that can, it's the same interest rate that is on the market in the non-Islamic banks, right?
Yeah. So because before I went into banking, my background, I did qualify as a chartered accountant first. And that was purely for monetary reasons, because I discovered if you did a chartered accountancy first, then your role in banking would be accelerated. So I did that first. So I'm reasonably familiar with training in financial statements and so on. So I do enjoy looking at financial statements of banks. I've looked at statements of Islamic banks in the UK, in the Middle East, and in Malaysia, the three main centers. And there's enormous parallels between them. So I'm yet to see. So I analyze the assets and liabilities. I analyze both. Sometimes that's not easy to do because the reporting standards are a bit different. The terminology we see on the notes and the balance sheets are quite different to what we expect conventionally. Like obviously, they cannot say interest because technically there's no interest in the transactions. So they use many different types of Arabic contractual terms that are used. But when you drill down, you know, once, and my expertise has been in understanding the contracts, understanding the products, how they're structured, and I know where interest is present within them, in the pricing of them. And so, yes, it's consistent. I see, you know, 95%, 98%, 99% of the assets and liabilities are consistently assets and liabilities that are priced at interest. And so for me, this is like it's a natural consequence of what they built to do. And also this tied in with over the years, and probably at the beginning I didn't understand, but over the years of what makes a bank a bank. You know, what's so important about a banking license? And it's only the last few years I began to understand the nuances of those. That a banking license, for example, enables credit creation, right? No other institution can execute credit creation without a banking license. And I've read some interesting papers. There's a Professor Werner who writes a lot about this kind of thing. And the last few years, I've read some of his papers, and he analyzes, like, what if the UK, for example, what is it in the constitution or the law that gives us permission to banks through double entry bookkeeping to create credit? And he was unable to find any link to law that gives us permission. But it's clear that this is the outcome. And so this led me to understand that when we have Islamic banks, so Islamic banks operate in various countries, but they have to be issued with licenses, banking licenses. And so they have the same drivers and motivators that a normal bank does. And you know, the main tool it has in its toolbox is credit creation. And Islamic banks have not been able to avoid that at all.
Yeah, this is really this is the key point here, which is credit creation, and this is this is what we're trying to get at in this discussion. We keep coming back to this issue, which is that the reason that fiat is incompatible with Islamic finance is that the current global financial and monetary system is built around credit creation. And in particular, you mentioned the idea of a banking license. So for the uninitiated, basically a banking license is like a license to print money. So in a regular bank, In the current fiat monetary system, when a bank issues a loan, when you go and you borrow to buy a house, this is really, I think, the most important fact people need to recognize about modern fiat. And it's the central fact from which the analysis of my latest book, The Fiat Standard, starts. When you go to buy a house from your local bank, they are not taking $1 million that they have on hand and giving them to you so that you could pay for your house. They are making those $1 million afresh. Those $1 million didn't exist before you walked into the bank. And then when you walked out, the money supply of the entire country has gone up by about $1 million or something close to that. So the way that the fiat monetary system functions is that money is constantly being created when debt is issued, when new loans are made. And debt is and money is being destroyed when loans are being repaid or defaults happen. So we have this enormous system where millions of financial institutions around the world, or maybe thousands, maybe not millions, thousands of financial institutions around the world are issuing loans and therefore creating new money. And then billions of people around the world are paying back those loans and then destroying some of that money. But obviously the money creation in general goes on much faster than the money destruction. And that's why the money supply is increasing. So the problem then for Islamic banks is that if they don't want to play this game, they are effectively subsidizing everybody else who's playing it. If you decided that you wanted to hold, if you decided that you didn't want to issue credit, that you didn't want to make new money, that you didn't want to do interest-based lending, you just wanted to hold other people's money and lend it out according to Islamic strictures, in which, you know, there's no interest, there's partnership. If you were to do that, and also you were to, you know, the two things that you could do as an Islamic bank would be investment banking and deposit banking. So people pay you money to keep your money, to keep their money with you safely. So if you were to do that, you're just holding people's money and charging them a storage fee, and also charging them effectively an inflation rate because their savings are declining in value. And you're giving up on the idea, on the ability to print money, which, you know, is basically like giving up on a money printer. You know, it's like having a money printer and turning it down. And so Islamic finance, in its traditional correct sense, is likely doomed in this kind of scenario. And that's why I think you're correct when you say that it's essentially just interest-bearing regular fiat banking, but with added Arabic words to signify the kind of transactions, right?
Yeah, I do agree with you, certainly. But I think it depends where you're coming from in this situation. So if you're coming from an economic angle, you're certainly right. If you're operating in a field where everyone else can create credit and you can't, it's not going to work, right? You're not going to make it. But if you're coming from an angle, which we are, which is from our religion, from commands of your creator, right, saying you can't do this, then you have to think, right? One, we can't do it. So what are our choices? Our choices are to replicate it, but to try to make it look like we're sticking with the rules. That's one choice. And the other choice, which is the harder choice, which is this is what we've been commanded. Now, what it means, I don't think we'll be commanded to do things that make us second-class citizens. I don't think we would be commanded to do things that make us poor. I think we're commanded to do things. And if we interpret this and say, look, this means we're excluded from credit creation, you know, poor us. For me, this is then the driver for us. It's demanding us to take steps. It's demanding us to rectify it. It's demanding, if you find yourselves in this situation, don't give up. Don't do interest-bearing loans. Don't do what you're told not to do. You have to fight it. You have to fight. You have to find your place in the economic world that you can survive and thrive. Because otherwise, we have to accept, if we think we cannot do it, we have to accept that we're being commanded by God to make us poor, to make us second class. And I think that's where we have the challenge. That to me, I see these restrictions on lending and interest, I see it as a direct challenge to Muslims to make our way in this world, that this economic world, economic system, is not designed for us. It really isn't designed for us. So what do we do? And how we react to it is the ultimate question. And so what I've seen is a direction of our resources, because Muslims have had, overall, we have had significant resources in the last few decades, right? If you look as a group as a whole, and you look at the direction of those direction of resources have been put into capitalizing 500 or 1,000 Islamic banks globally. And that direction of capital, human capital, we have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Muslims working in these banks. And all their talent and skill and goodwill is being directed to credit creation and interest-based activities. So for me, it's a question of, you know, not so much competing with other people at the rules that they've set, but we should be redirecting the capital and the resources and the human talent we have towards something that's more productive. And I think when we say what is more productive, it's really ultimately the quite simple things. It's about allocation of capital. It's about the distribution of capital to productive and enterprise means. Because we have to earn some revenue somehow. Otherwise, you know, through the mechanism of zakat, if we ignore, you know, interest that's going on in the rest of the world and inflation, that will erode our capital. Even through our internal mechanism of paying 2.5% wealth on tax on wealth, we have to compete against that through the intelligent allocation of capital, so we earn more than that 2.5%. You know, and it seems that we've turned our backs on that. And we've just agreeing to be second-class citizens in an interest-based economy. And I find that incredibly frustrating.
Yeah. So let me sort of get your ideas on what should be done. So I think we're clear on the diagnosis, and I know a lot of people will probably disagree with you and I, but you know, let's take the advantage of being on the same page here. I think I agree with you. I think it's, and this is something that I've known superficially without having studied economics for a very long time. I think, you know, many religious authorities say this, that what is going on in Islamic banks is just the same thing. They offer you interest, but they call it something else. And so the choices are, and you mentioned, you know, there's the, let's mimic it, but give it some names. And, you know, the drawbacks to that is that, A, obviously the biggest drawback for Muslims is that it is against the, you're not fooling God if you're just giving it another name. He knows what all the names mean and he knows how this works. So, the biggest drawback for Muslims is that it's against your religion. But I think there's another drawback here, which is that the way that it operates, it almost operates, I think you can, and this is not a nice thing to say, and I hope people who work in Islamic banking don't take it personally, but I think, I don't think they mean it to be this way, but I think there is an element of it looking a little bit like an affinity scam, in that you put up these Islamic verses and words and sayings, and you call your products with Islamic names, and then that gets you into the Islamic community, and then that allows those people to, people you know to bring in their friends and family. It almost functions like just a way to affinity market. It's or maybe I shouldn't have said affinity scam. I should just say affinity marketing. That it's a way of packaging regular fiat interest loans to Muslims. And I think the net effect is probably that you just end up paying a little bit extra if you're into Islamic finance. Like if you just go to your regular non-Islamic bank and compare the rates, you're basically paying an Islamic premium. So there's a tiny little bit of premium that goes into, making the regulatory and all the extra steps that they need to take in order to make it look like it's halal. So this doesn't seem like it is a very sustainable option, and we have problems with it. But my question to you is, do you think it's better to just go and use regular banks? If you're a Muslim, do you just go and use regular banks and not put on with all of the facade? Or what else? Well, tell us, what are your thoughts on using regular banks? Do you think it makes sense? And, you know, obviously, I know you're not a sheikh and you shouldn't be giving fatwas, but, just your opinions. If we're saying that the Islamic finance is basically riba, then why not just use the regular riba?
Okay, so my position is that Islamic banks are built on interest. They have to be. And it's a choice. They've made that choice. So you raise a very interesting point, is how do we square this with the fact that the vast, vast majority of Muslims who have an interaction with an Islamic bank, these Muslims are genuine people, right? And they want to abide by their religion and they're sincere people. So whether you work at an Islamic bank or you're a customer at an Islamic bank, you do it because you, as far as you believe, you're abiding with the requirements of our religion. And the vast majority of people are sincere Muslims. So it's become a very difficult thing to reconcile. You have institutions that are built on interest. And so the reason I can say this, I remember, for example, years ago when I first moved across from conventional banking to Islamic banking, my first role was to execute deals in the international money markets for Islamic banks. And so I would be in the middle of cash flows, going all around the world between Islamic banks and conventional banks. But these were money market flows in all kinds of currencies. And I was involved in pricing and executing them. And the pricing was, of course, interest. But it was structured within the transaction so that it's not interest, it's a margin on the sale. And so later on, when I began to look back and understand how banks are constructed and created, and looking at the cash flows of banks, so these Now, these kinds of cash flows in the money markets, it's like the blood, it's like the engine of the bank. And these are built around interest. And later on, when I understood about credit creation, then I understand why it has to be built on interest, such that then every branch that grows from it, it has to be lending at interest. But the vast, but most Muslims are not exposed to this. You know, most Muslims don't know how banks run, how credit creation works, and how interbank money markets work. So for most Muslims, our interaction with Islamic banking is that it's been something that's been deemed to be halal and permissible. So we have pronouncements from scholars. And I think this involvement of scholars has made this whole Islamic banking concept into something incredibly difficult to understand for people. So no longer do we just have commercial entities. So you could have an Islamic bank putting forward its platform and saying, this is what we do. Now, use us if you want to. And if you don't want to, you don't use us. But they have aligned themselves with scholars, that scholars have to give approval on their activities. When you do this, this has a massive psychological impact on Muslims, that this is halal. You know, I don't understand how banks operate, but this is halal. The savings account is halal. This home financing is permissible. So really, what's the problem? And so when I've approached this with Muslims, I find that there's a very high hurdle to overcome with Muslims, that they cannot understand that something they are continuously told is permissible by specific scholars and fatwas, for example. They cannot then understand how could this involve something impermissible like lending at interest. It's a hurdle that most Muslims cannot clear. And my personal view is that I think it's very unethical. I think we're in an area where you're combining religion and money. And in Islam, we do, because as I mentioned at the beginning, our approach to finance and money is driven by our religion. We're told what to do and what not to do. But beyond that, you can't lend and you can't gamble. Beyond that, everything is permissible to us. All enterprise is permissible, as long as we're not doing things that are specifically haram. Everything is permissible. So when you combine the act of banking and interest-based activities on the one hand, and then scholars on the other hand, it puts Muslims in a very difficult position. And for me, I'm a big opponent of that, because I feel Muslims' goodwill is being utilized and taken advantage of.
Yeah, I think that is a very good point. And I think, maybe we need to use this in order to not become poor, but then once you start putting all of these fatwas and labels saying this is great, this is perfect, well, then people, it goes far beyond what you need to do in order to just avoid to be poor, and then you end up with people just overdoing it in terms of risk and gambling and speculation and interest and all of those things.
Yeah, I think if there was a position, which is my position, that if banks were to be honest and say, look, we've chosen to be active in the banking sector, because again, that's a choice. We've chosen this while perhaps our intention is in time to develop something better. But while we're here, we find ourselves in a credit creation sector and a system. So the things we have to do really have to look like precisely what our competitors are doing. And they could say, we do this reluctantly. We do this because we know it's not ideal, but we have an aim to the next steps to move forward. If that was the stance, and that's something that I could understand, but the stance continues to be, if any observation is made that Islamic banks are doing interest-based activities, the reaction is intensely confrontational. It'll be absolutely rejected. They say, we do not do this. We're not allowed to do this. Also, we have A, B, C to prove that we do not do it. And to me, it's that step to me that then drives me from being a Muslim who just wants to see a halal version of economics and finance develop and to support Islamic banks. It moves me from there to saying, well, actually, I think once you take this step, and remember I mentioned Islamic banks are still absorbing capital, they're absorbing human talent. If you want to work in Islamic finance, you're generally going to work for an Islamic bank. So when you combine that with the confrontational attitude of Islamic banks, to me, then I think we reach a stage where we're doing damage. To me, I think Islamic banking as it is actually doing damage. So often, one thing I say, and some people don't quite understand this, I say that Islamic banks as they are today, they do more damage to Muslims than if they did not exist. You know, it's worse than not existing. Because at least if you did not exist, Muslims have like a clear playing ground to start from.
Yeah. I guess, you know, the counter argument here would be, I mean, I'm sympathetic to the idea, but I think the counter argument here would be that, you know, imagine if you're a Muslim living in a society where there's inflation and you're trying to save up for a house. It's really, really difficult. And if you end up getting a housing loan and, you know, you do it with the intention of getting an Islamic loan, I mean, you end up with a house and you end up being able to afford a house, which you probably wouldn't have been able to do with an inflationary currency, unless, you know, unless you basically become a Warren Buffett level expert in allocating investments so that you could beat inflation reliably with your savings. But that, of course, means you can't have any other job. So then you're effectively, you know, all Muslims have to be investors. And I think this is kind of a broader problem with the fiat system, in that everybody needs to be an investor in this kind of system because, you know, initially, under the fiat system, the idea was, well, you just put your money in the bank and you get an interest rate that is higher than inflation. And that was fine. You know, if we have an inflationary money, your bank will be able to, you know, there'll be more economic production taking place because of the magic of inflation. And then magically, that means your bank is more profitable and your bank can pay you a higher interest rate. But of course, this was just another way of doing Keynesian borrowing from the future to pay our bills today. And that didn't last. And so people had to go from the checking, from the saving account to the bond market in order to save. And then that's not working out much anymore. And now you have to basically be in stocks. And now you have to study balance sheets and equities and figure out how to allocate your money into stocks just to beat inflation. So in a sense, the world is kind of joining in this problem that Muslims have had for a much longer time. The rest of the world is having it now. You know, you need to be figuring out how to invest in order to just keep the money that you've earned. But yeah, so I mean, we've painted ourselves into a corner with this discussion. Into basically, you know, what do you choose? Which do you take, the poison that's branded poison, or do you take the poison that's branded honey? But you know, thankfully, like with everything on planet Earth, Bitcoin fixes this, and Bitcoin is the solution for everything, obviously. But this one as well, I think I've been fascinated by this idea over over the past year or so, by just how Bitcoin really is the perfect piece to solve this puzzle of Islamic finance. How do Muslims carry out finance in the modern world? Because, well, I guess, you know, one way that we could answer this is that we could build a, one way we could answer the question of how do Muslims act is, well, Muslims should just build their gold-backed businesses and banks and then have a gold-based banking system and have it built around a currency that's not inflationary, and Islamic countries should adopt gold instead of inflationary fiat. But, you know, if you've followed events over the 20th century, you know that that's not exactly an item that is on the menu of options available for any bank or nation state in the world. You just don't do gold-backed banking anymore because the governments of the world, the powerful governments of the world, don't let you. And my book, The Fiat Standard, has discussed this at length. There's no real banking being built on gold anywhere in the world, and it's no coincidence. It's not because nobody has thought about it. Obviously, the whole world had a banking system based on gold leading up until 1914. But gold banking has been criminalized. You can't just set up a bank and accept gold deposits and give people gold receipts. It's not legal for you to do that. If you want to be a bank, you have to be licensed by your local central bank. And your local central bank will only allow you to be a bank if you engage in the same fractional reserve banking that they do themselves. And then your central bank is only going to be allowed to be a central bank. It can only join the IMF if it uses fiat currencies to settle with the rest of the world. The IMF prohibits all of its members from backing their currencies with gold, and the US is not very keen about countries using gold reserves. So You know, the analog solution for Muslims is to do gold banking, as is discussed in Islam, but that's not a possibility today because of all of the political reasons that I mentioned. And herein lies the wonder of Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is just basically gold with wings. Well, I'm sure many people are going to be upset with this description. It's more than that. But as far as I'm concerned, the most powerful thing about Bitcoin is that it's gold with wings. It can fly. It can cross borders. You can send it halfway around the world for pennies or dollars. Even if transaction fees rise enormously, they're still enormously cheap compared to sending gold. You know, sending $1 billion worth of gold across the Atlantic is going to cost somewhere in the range of 1% of the total value of the gold. So it's extremely expensive. And, you know, to send it across the Atlantic and to make sure that you've received actual gold rather than just, you know, somebody swapping it out with their tungsten-filled bars, you need to verify it. And the only way to verify a gold bar is to melt it down and recast it again. So this is really the impediment for Islamic gold banking developing. It's that it's extremely expensive to move gold around. And the only way that you can move it around, you know, if you want to build infrastructure for countries to settle with one another, you need the permission of your local government. And local governments, of course, are living off of the fiat spigot, so they're not keen for it, to it. And that's where Bitcoin comes in. Bitcoin is like gold. It's it's an asset that is not debt-based. You know, fiat money is debt-based, as I was explaining earlier. It's the entire thing is made out of debt. The money itself is generated when debt is generated. But that's not true for gold, and that's not true for Bitcoin. But with Bitcoin, global banking around Bitcoin is basically unstoppable. And that's really why I find it to be a very compelling case for Muslims. I think, you know, there's a very strong compelling case for why you should stay away from regular interest and regular riba banks. And I think you make a compelling case for why stay away from Islamic banks. And, you know, if those are the two options, like if you're a Muslim and you care about your religion and you care about doing what is asked of you, you can't tell me that engaging in Islamic-based riba is a better option than just using Bitcoin. What do you think?
You know, of course, there's many points that you made. So first of all, I would say, so in terms of Bitcoin, I'm quite new to the game. I probably found out in a meaningful way about Bitcoin no more than 3 years ago. Okay, and so since then, it's been very interesting for me to learn about it. Actually, one of the first people to introduce me to Bitcoin. So I was hearing this for a while from people who were saying, Safta, your view on credit creation and Islamic banks is consistent with something like Bitcoin, but I never really made the connection. So I was introduced to it. Actually, somebody sent me your book about 2 years ago. And this was somebody who I know on Twitter, and I've never met them. And she was very kind. And so she asked me my address. Of course, she lives abroad. And I got a book in the post. And you know, nowadays, we hardly send out anything to anybody in the post unless it's like closed for Christmas or something. So it was quite touching to get a physical book in the post from somebody I've never met. And it was your book, because that's the first time I'd heard of you. And I just heard of the Bitcoin a little bit, but not that much. So I'm quite new to the game in Bitcoin. And I would say I'm generally supportive of it, but I'm not, my support is not unconditional. You don't know how things are going to turn out. But the more I find out about Bitcoin, the more I do sort of like the premise it's built on, and it's quite pleasing to see that the impact it's having and the uptake it has, it seems to be growing. And so for me, that's positive. But I'm not an unconditional supporter of Bitcoin, but I do like the kinds of things that Bitcoin stands for. So for example, when we talk about gold and silver, so often, you know, when we have our hadith and narrations from the early times of our religion, when they talk about money, it's always gold and silver, because this is what was used. And so in modern times, when Muslims talk about an economic system and maybe getting away from the fiat system, we talk about gold and silver. And I think there have been some movements. I don't know if any have been meaningful. There have been some movements, probably not government-led. I'm talking about private movements to try to establish something like a currency system based on gold or silver. but I've not seen any takeoff. I've not seen any come to any meaningful size. So this remains almost like, I'm not sure what the right word, almost like the ideal solution that Muslims think about. They think about going back to gold, right? Because it's specifically mentioned in our classic literature. And I can understand that because gold is, I guess it's the original sound money, right? But in modern terms, it's not clear to me if we can reproduce the complexity of a modern economy with something like gold. It's just not clear to me because I'm not an economist. I'm more of a banker. And one thing I would say in terms of how Muslims fit into this conversation, what I would like, I would hope that more Muslims, first of all, understand about fiat money and credit creation. Then I would hope that Muslims understand more about Bitcoin. And you see, the issue I have is when I speak to Muslims about Bitcoin, there's actually an interesting layer of Muslims who already get it, right? And they got it before I did. And they're very much into Bitcoin and they know about fiat and credit creation. And that's fantastic. Like, and it's interesting. For example, when I speak to people who are into Bitcoin, it's like I don't need to speak to them about credit creation and fiat and banking. Like, they all know, right? It's all just understood. But when I speak to normal Muslims who are like normal people, when I talk about Bitcoin, for example, I think for most people, it's difficult to differentiate Bitcoin and crypto. So the first thing, then people ask me about crypto. And I say, well, you know, when I talk about crypto, I don't like talking about crypto, but I'll talk about Bitcoin. Because in my mind, they're two different things. But I think in most people's minds, they're probably not two different things. And so I think there's a big, so outside of the people who just know and get it, I think amongst normal people, I think there's quite a long way to go to understand potentially what Bitcoin is. So when I speak to Muslims, I do like to point them towards Bitcoin, not to buy it or support it or go crazy, but just I say, look at Bitcoin, look why it was established and what it does. And for me, I think one of the tipping points for me when I discovered a bit about Bitcoin was the in the Genesis block, you know, the reference to the banks being bailed out by the Chancellor, that headline. To me, when I saw that, that really hit it home to me that, look, whoever it was, right, who created Bitcoin, whoever it was, that he really, part of his motivation was to oppose banking and oppose the impact that banks have on our system. Because then at that time, we were looking at the second bailout for banks and we're looking at, you know, austerity, long-term impact. So to me, this told me, this is somebody who really understands banking and he's trying to do something to oppose it. So for me, I would say that the value I attach to something like Bitcoin is that I see it as a direct opponent to banking and lending. And this fits in with my worldview because as a Muslim, I am told to detest lending and banking and interest. So for me, it all fits quite nicely.
Yeah, I think it fits really well. I think the best kind of, or maybe the most brief kind of case that you can make to it is that currently, the vast majority of the world's wealth that is saved in bonds. You know, if you want to have money that you don't want to take a lot of risk with, you put it in bonds. You put it in high-grade corporate bond and in government bonds and so on. And that's, you know, that's what pretty much everybody does as part of their investment portfolio. Well, not everybody, but you know, there's about $140 trillion of money invested in bonds around the world. And that's a lot of money. That's more than there is in checking accounts. That's more than the money supply of the world. So this kind of use case of saving, you know, and the people who are buying bonds are not buying bonds to get rich. They're buying bonds in order to not get poor. You know, the idea is that bonds will protect you from inflation. So you get a small little interest rate that prevents you from losing value over inflation. So it's but if you're a Muslim and you do that, you are engaging in riba. And Bitcoin is the only other is the only other institutional grade asset or that you could use as a form of saving, as a form of cash in the role of bonds. And it's the only hard asset that you could use that you could also send around the world, that you could also trade with. And this is really the key thing. So yeah, instead of holding bonds, you could hold gold. And over the last decade, it hasn't done well compared to bonds and gold, I would say. But still, you know, historically, it has kind of protected people from inflation. It's still doing that job today. You know, if you're the gold is flat against the dollar, but it's massively up against the majority of national currencies that are constantly devaluing against the dollar. So you can do that. Gold, you can have a little bit of gold that'll protect you from inflation, but good luck settling your currency, your company's bills with gold. You know, when your central bank goes belly up and there are capital controls and your business needs to pay its suppliers, but the suppliers, but the central bank won't let you pay your suppliers, you can't pay them with gold. It's not convenient. You can't send large quantities of it. But with Bitcoin, you can. So At a very simple level, I think the case is extremely convincing. There's no riba involved in the creation of Bitcoin. There is riba involved in creation of bonds. Rather than holding bonds, and bonds, of course, are used to finance governments that do all kinds of horrific things with their money. So rather than financing all these governments and engaging in riba, just hold Bitcoin. And, you know, the performance of Bitcoin has... I mean, it's not even comparable to the performance of bonds. Bonds, you take on risk and so that you can now pay them an interest. You know, there's negative rates on some of these bonds. So you're taking on risk and you're paying for the pleasure of taking on risk. Whereas with Bitcoin, you're paying for the pleasure of taking on credit risk. Whereas Bitcoin has no credit risk, has no counterparty risk. You can hold it yourself. It's a real commodity that you can hold. And it doesn't offer you interest, but it appreciates significantly because its supply is fixed and nobody can manipulate it.
But, you know, this gets me back to thinking that, so for me, when I first found out about Bitcoin, it was very logical. I understood, you know, understood why it was created, how it works. And I'm fascinated by the mathematics behind it as well. But of course, I don't understand most of it. But it, to me, it's very fascinating. But if you look at the average person, for example, if you speak to the average person about why Bitcoin is sad, if you speak about banking and credit creation and fiat money, I mean, maybe it's difficult for the average person to understand that, right? And I think this goes back into, so for example, credit creation, you know, I think the first time I saw it officially explained was in a Bank of England bulletin in 2014. Like, they were explicit. They say economics teaches this, but it's not true. There's no fractional reserve banking. There's no intermediation by banks is credit creation. And also credit creation was explained in a book by the Federal Reserve, right, in 1968, I think. So the idea of credit creation, it's been around, right, but it's not very public and not very well known. And for me, so my angle in this is specifically for Muslims, because it's the arena that I'm in, right? Muslims and money and finance, and Bitcoin has found its way in there. So when you want to speak to Muslims, and this is something I think about education of people, because most people are not finance people. Most people are not bankers and not economists, right? The average person. So if I speak to them about something like Bitcoin, so first of all, and this is a psychology of Muslims, and maybe it's replicated among psychology of people in general, but then you have to consider about the source of the authority, right? Authority for Muslims often in our everyday lives, it's the government, first of all. And the second thing, when it comes to money, a lot of Muslim countries have Islamic banking. In the UK, we don't. And we have only one or two banks, which have never taken off. But in many Muslim countries, there's Islamic banks. And as I explained, they're heavily integrated with the religious side. They have scholars and they have approvals and fatwa. So when you're talking about something like Bitcoin, you're challenging people's understanding of these kinds of things. And when Muslims will look to authority, they look to their government. Like, what's that government saying? And second, they look to the banks. Well, what are the banks saying, right? So in both of these, as you will know, when it comes to Bitcoin, these are not the people that you should be going to for opinions. So for me, it's for psychologically and how, you know, the makeup of people, it's fascinating for me, the kind of hurdles that we need to overcome to help the average person understand the value of something, if not Bitcoin, but something like Bitcoin.
Yeah, I agree. And I've noticed, I've made the same observation. I think in general, I you know, I have on average more trouble with explaining Bitcoin to Muslims and Arabs, I think, because of this deferring to authority. There's just this idea that, well, it doesn't matter what I think about it. There are experts who know those things. And if this is really the better money, you know, they'll tell me. And until they do, you're just another weird guy on the internet with a crazy idea. I think I mean, obviously, this is kind of the default for the majority of people everywhere in the world. But I think in probably in Islamic societies, it might be overrepresented compared to the West, and I think it's an impediment to the rise of Bitcoin. But of course, another big impediment, other than just the banks and the governments, of course, are religious authorities. Now, interestingly, here, religious authorities that are in Islamic countries today will very rarely ever. Or will never, basically, the approved official religious authorities will never tell you that your national currency is riba, which is, I think, indisputable by Islamic standards. And when whatever your currency is, it's created when your central bank lends your government. It's created when the government issues treasury bonds. It's created when banks issue loans. So the money itself is riba. If you're holding the piece of paper, it's not like a piece of gold, because it's not a commodity that is bought and sold on the market with its own value. It's a piece of paper that is somebody's debt. Somebody got into riba debt in order for this to happen. So this I would think is a pretty significant detail. But of course, you know, official religious authorities don't bring this up because, you know, they are generally approved by the governments that benefit from these money printers. Yet somehow they find a lot of fault with Bitcoin. So a lot of religious scholars are constantly going on about why Bitcoin is bad and Bitcoin is wrong. What do you think of this debate? What do you think are the what are the best arguments you've found for why Bitcoin is haram, and what are the best that you've found for why it's halal? And for those who don't understand the terminology, haram means that it is forbidden and halal means that it is allowed.
Okay, so from my position, first of all, yeah, it's interesting to see how people approach money first, how they approach fiat money first, and then how they approach Bitcoin. Because to me, the two are intricately linked. If you understand fiat money and what it is and its impact, its connection with riba. So you're right. In the UK, I mean, there's an organization called Positive Money, which I'm really supportive of. So it's not Muslims at all, but they're just after justice, right? And so they do very good information on the UK specifically. So they have data that says in the UK money supply, so only 3% of our money supply is physical, right? 80% is bank credit creation, and 17% is central bank reserves. So up to 97% is created through interest, through riba. And so, of course, all the money that I'm, you know, I get paid a salary. And when I spend in shops, it's all electronic. So everything I use is created by interest. And this is something I think Muslims don't understand. And I think it's an understanding that's not encouraged as well. Because, again, as we said, when we go back to the source of authority, it's governments and banking especially. So this is something that they could never really admit to, the connection between money supply and interest. Because I think once you do accept that, then I think it's a very natural conversation to look at something like Bitcoin. But to the extent that you don't accept that, so that's not accepted, then when you look at Bitcoin, I would say personally for me, so when I analyze Bitcoin from a religious point of view, this is just me as an individual. I don't give rulings, but I couldn't find anything problematic with it at all. I do have a little bit of understanding of Islamic law. I do teach Islamic law at university, but it's a very superficial understanding. But personally, for me, I didn't find a problem with it. The only thing on an individual level that I guess I regret, I understand, but I regret, I guess I dislike the aspect that the volatility in price can attract players who are not in it for the same reason. And, you know, just intellectually, I guess I just don't like that. It makes it a bit seedy, right? But I do understand the causes for that in terms of the state of the evolution of Bitcoin. And then where there's quick capital to be made, you get influx of certain capital seekers and arbitrage and speculation. So what I would say is that, especially for Muslims, who are not very knowledgeable, like most people, when they see a chance to make a lot of money, I guess in any crypto they can, but in Bitcoin as well, I do regret that a lot of people are attracted to this to try to make money, and a lot of people will lose money. So I would say that's one thing that I just wish was not there as part of the landscape with Bitcoin. In terms of how Muslims interact with it and scholars especially, so I do see some opinions recently either saying they're neutral about Bitcoin, or one or two have actually said there's nothing haram about Bitcoin. They actually say it's okay. So interestingly, how I see it dealt with, when I see pronouncements in general, whether so governments don't make pronouncements, but bodies of scholars. So when I see these pronouncements, often they don't talk about Bitcoin itself. They talk about crypto in general. And when you talk about crypto as a whole, you know, it's a bit of a nonsense, right? And you're grouping up the next shitcoin that's come out, 10,000 shitcoins with Bitcoin, and they give a uniform pronouncement, and then it's difficult to attach too much value to it. Because of the place that Bitcoin has, and the opposition it has to banking, and the place that Islamic banks have linked to governments and authority, I think we're in a very interesting place that I don't think we're going to get very clear answers, because those who are providing opinions, if they're incentivized at all, they're generally incentivized by those who oppose Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's very true. And I think I think the argument that you make about the volatility is probably the kind of the strongest one that they have against Bitcoin. Because if you look at how Bitcoin operates, I mean, yes, it's digital, but it functions, but it operates no different from any kind of market commodity. It gets mined. Nobody can make it for free. Nobody has the ability to produce it and foist it to the world for free. Everybody has to work for it, and the cost of producing it is roughly equal to the cost of the market, to its price on the market, because it's a competitive production and there's a difficulty adjustment. And so it's just any other market commodity, like all others. It's inconceivable for me how you could find a religious objection to this. And then, when you look at the volatility and you see that it does 20% in a day, up or down, and then, you know, obviously that attracts a lot of speculation. It looks like gambling. It looks like another Ponzi scheme, and it looks like just another silly investment. And that, I think, and of course, you know, we've had a lot of crazy schemes over the past decades of fiat. Everybody has a lesson. You know, their uncle and their grandfather told them about the one time where everybody thought they were going to get rich and then didn't work out. So everybody's been burned by fiat adventures in the last century. So they're naturally going to be very skeptical. And when they see this volatility, it rings off all the alarm bells. But I think, you know, the volatility is, and the fact that there is speculation, is true for many other commodities. You know, if this was your criteria, then you would also say that gold is haram, wheat is haram, oil is haram. There are people who trade and make money and do leverage trading on all of these things, and their price can be volatile. And that's the same case with Bitcoin. However, you know, the deeper problem with all of this volatility and the markets, and the reason people are, you know, the reason so many people are able to not have real jobs and instead just spend their day gambling on movements in the price of oil or gold or Bitcoin or anything, is the fact that we don't have a sound monetary system. And so everything is up in the air. Money's being printed all the time, and money's circulating in the across different sectors in different ways. And so therefore you get these massive bubbles and these massive crashes. And work becomes an insignificant detail compared to being able to speculate correctly. So this is really a symptom of fiat, which Bitcoin fixes. If you did have a monetary system built around Bitcoin, it would be similar to gold. And there was a lot less empty speculation under gold, and there was a lot more conscious investing. But I think it's unfortunate that these kind of objections continue to get a lot of prominence. What do you think are ways in which we could subvert this kind of anti-Bitcoin propaganda in the Islamic world? How do we orange pill more Muslims?
Well, okay, so So to be clear, maybe because to be honest, I don't know the nature of people that you typically get on this podcast, for example. So for me, so I just want to reiterate, I like Bitcoin because how I understand its stance against banking and credit creation and interest. I have no idea if Bitcoin is going to work or not, because I'm not intelligent enough to understand that. But if Bitcoin doesn't work, then I would like to think something like Bitcoin would work, right? So in terms of how to orange pill Muslims, so for me, I think it goes back to the origins, right? The origin of money, credit creation, the banking system, and looking at the implications of that. I think without that, it's difficult to differentiate Bitcoin from many other cryptos. I think if you don't have that understanding, the Bitcoin looks like a dozen other cryptos. Okay. And I think once you have that understanding, and for me, having that understanding and also some anecdotal evidence like the code in the Genesis block, those were the triggers for me. And then everything just fell together and it was just as clear as day to me that Bitcoin is something that, you know, it opposes riba. It's not just designed as a counterbalance to riba. In my view, it's a direct challenge and a call out to riba. It's not just coincidental. And so something like that to me was incredibly powerful. And I think to Muslims, that would be incredibly powerful if they understood it, if they understood that this was the reason behind the creation. And then I think if you go into some of the technical sides about, the stable supply, distributed ledger, blockchain, the mathematics behind it, I think that can then support the initial approach. But I think really it's the lack of knowledge about fiat money that's holding Muslims back in terms of the understanding of Bitcoin.
Yeah. I think more, even more impressive than the fact that it is a challenge to fiat and to riba is the fact that it is a working alternative. This is kind of the slap in the face. Like everybody who really puts some time into thinking about it, particularly, you know, Muslims who are in finance, you know, they'll come to the conclusion that, yeah, there's just no way around having to play the game in the modern world, and it eats them up inside, but they still justify it. Well, with Bitcoin, all right, okay, yes, granted, it does look like it's a Ponzi scheme. It is volatile. It does have all of these, image problems going against it. But, you know, if you can peel beyond the surface and, you know, look under, you'll see that it's a system that works and allows you to get out of riba in a much better way. You know, instead of holding debt, instead of basically doing what everybody in fiat does, which is you hold bonds, which are riba, and then you borrow in order to finance your own expenditures. Bitcoin allows you to hold your savings in a form of money that appreciates and then buy money with these savings. You know, it becomes possible to actually do it because, look at how Bitcoin performs and how it performs compared to fiat over time. And then, yeah, it becomes possible to actually just save up for a house if you buy Bitcoin, you know, and you can finish college, work for a few years, and then buy a house in cash if you hold Bitcoin. So that saves you from having to hold bonds, that saves you from having to take out a mortgage. I think this is, maybe I'm being too optimistic, but I think once it begins to click for some people that this is the case, and then, some religious authorities begin to understand the implications of this, I think it's going to, we just need to get to that kind of tipping point, and then I think it'll catch on like wildfire.
But when you say catching on like wildfire, for example, so what? How would that manifest itself? Or what would be the consequence of that? Like what's the benefit of Bitcoin catching on?
Yeah, I mean, I think what would happen is that a lot of Muslims who are currently have a problem with where to store their wealth, you know, they have gold, which they can't move around and they can't send, and they have to use the Islamic Finance Bank, and they have to also sometimes use the regular bank because of, you know, they need specific products for their business. All of these people could just then substitute away from that by holding Bitcoin. And I think the implication will be that number go up because that's, you know, the underlying technology behind Bitcoin. So it's great because the wealth of people who hold it would go up over time. So I think once we get to this realization where the, you know, there's the self-interest aspect of this is increasing in value, and you can help yourself and make yourself better off by using it. But also, you know, you're actually freeing yourself from getting into riba, and you're getting out of the riba monster and being able to live in better accordance with your religious values. This is why I think there's there might come a point where it catches on in a very powerful way. I think the vast majority of Muslims haven't thought about it this way yet. But if we get to a point where they have, and I think, you know, it's a matter of time, because the way that I see it going, you know, assuming this happens, that Bitcoin continues to work, Bitcoin continues to increase in value, and it just doesn't go away, and then all of the people that said that it's a stupid scam end up looking foolish, and then they start revisiting, there's just no escaping it. There's no running away from this realization, I think. And eventually, perhaps, I don't know, somebody mentioned this on Twitter, perhaps there is more potential for this adoption, because there's a fertile ground of people who don't like riba and don't like fiat. And if you just can market it to them that this is the way out, if they get that connection, then that's a much more powerful incentive for adoption than in societies that don't have it. You know, if you think about in the West, all right, it's very difficult to get people to understand what the problem is with fiat. You said it's difficult to get Muslims to understand it, for sure. But I think simply having that starting stone of riba as a problem gets you, as a starting spot, gets you pretty far ahead. So who knows?
Yeah, I think right at the end, you raise a point that I think resonates mostly with me, which is riba, that Muslims, you know, when you look at solutions to riba or challenges to riba, that we are seeing something like Bitcoin, and there's some other movements, not coins, but social movements that speak out against debt and riba, and they do it from a point of view of justice and equality and oppression. Now, when it comes to Muslims, even if we don't understand the consequent impact on oppression and justice and equality, we are demanded by a religion to take a stance against riba, and we don't. So, but I think if you do educate Muslims on this point, on the riba alone, then I think we have a compulsion that other people don't, because our religion demands it. So I think if we can get over that hurdle with Muslims, there's like an automatic demand to oppose it, to oppose credit creation and fiat. Not just an ideological demand. It's a religious demand to oppose it. And I think that would be interesting for me if we can just get Muslims over that hurdle.
Yeah, very much so. And I think, if you look at it, the way that fiat operates, the way that it's operated over the last century, you can think about it as a systematic tax against Muslims, because they are not the ones that are benefiting from inflation. They engage in debt a lot less. You know, Islamic finance gets them in the game a little bit, reduces the amount of wealth that is siphoned off. But generally, as individuals and as governments and institutions and corporations in the Islamic world, they would have been far more likely to hold cash and far less likely to get into debt over the last 100 years all over the world. You know, the average Muslim individual or company or government will have done this. And that just means you're paying for it with inflation. That just means that inflation is devaluing your cash, and that the people who are getting into the most debt are the ones who are benefiting, because and that's a central idea in my book, The Fiat Standard. You know, people discuss the Cantillon effect, wherein it describes how if you have a money printer, the people who get the money straight out of the printer benefit the most, because, you know, they got it when the prices were not rising yet. And they got it straight from the printer. And then when they go spend that money, they buy things at the original prices. But then after they spend it, that money leads to an increase in prices. So the next people who get the money will, they get it when only a small amount of prices have gone up. So they still benefit a little bit. So the further away you are from the printer, the less you benefit until you get to a point where you're hurt. So the people closest to the printer benefit the most, and the people furthest away from the printer are hurt the most. And generally, of course, it's, you know, the richest are the ones closest to the printer. It's the biggest corporations and their biggest banks that are the ones that get the lowest, that are the ones that get the money printing. And it's the poorest who are not. And in the fiat system, you don't have a physical money printer, but you have a debt printer. And so the banks and the financial institutions that are able to issue debt, and the governments, of course, that are able to issue the biggest amounts of debt at the lowest interest rates, are the ones that are benefiting from the inflationary credit creation. Whereas the people who hold savings and the people who aren't able to borrow a lot are the ones who are basically paying. So I think over the past century, you know, you play this out and you see, yeah, savings, people who held savings, got dispossessed effectively, and people who got into debt had their debts effectively alleviated or reduced in value over time because the currency was always inflating and reducing in value. So I think the powerful idea that Muslims might like here is that there's another world out there in which this giant inflation, the credit inflation tax, does not exist. And in that case, I think, you know, Muslims are far better off because they, you know, in a world in which the entire world economy runs on Bitcoin, you hold your money in Bitcoin, nobody creating debt reduces your the value of your savings.
Yeah, I think you make some really good points about how Muslims interact with debt. And I think at every angle, you know, when we interact with debt and riba, we get the worst deal out of everybody on the planet. I think you're right. First of all, if you want to borrow money to buy a house, even if you go to an Islamic bank, we do it reluctantly. We don't like interest. And also, Islamic bank rates are high. Like, we pay more than everybody else, and we still have 25-year, 30-year claim on our working lives. And also, because we don't like debt in general and riba, we're much less likely to take the leverage route when it comes to enterprise and investment, like buying property through leverage and then cycling that through. Like, you know, a lot of people who make a lot of money in property, it's through leverage, for example, and through businesses as well. You know, you get leverage buyouts, high leverage, high acceleration of your rate of accumulating profit. Muslims who are moral don't have this route to creating wealth. But still, they're forced to go down the route of acquiring debt and riba. So, on both sides, we get the worst of both worlds, and you're quite right about that. So, the thing that drives me, and I'm fascinated by all of this, is that to me, it's clear to me that our religion drives us to consider these things, and it drives us to challenge these things, and it drives us to find a solution to them. And that's how I see my religion, because I see it as incredibly powerful. I don't think my religion tells me to be a victim. My religion's telling me to educate myself, find out how the world works, then find a solution. It's like, stop complaining, but find a solution. And this is where I really hope Muslims will get to, that, you know, and again, with fiat money as well, even if you explain fiat to a lot of people, they will just say, well, what can we do? Well, what can I do? And when we explain this to Muslims, well, what can we do? How can we fight riba? It's, you just have to find a way. But everybody has their own impetus, right? But I believe our impetus comes from our religion, which should be, I mean, you know how Muslims think. When it comes to our religion, we think quite strongly, right? So that impetus should be stronger than any impetus that non-Muslims have, right? Because non-Muslims have an impetus based on morals and values, but ours should be higher. And that's why it's fascinating to me when I see movements that are effective against fiat money and riba and these kinds of things. Generally, these movements are not from Muslims; they're from non-Muslims who just see what's wrong. And so, I want to find a way to get Muslims just over that final hump, because we should be greater opponents of the things that Bitcoin opposes.
Absolutely. All right. Does anybody have any questions for Safdar? Or Safdar, do you have any questions that you'd like to ask me or anybody from the attendance? All right, Peter has a question.
Hi, Safdar. Thanks for sharing all of your insights today. This has been a really interesting discussion. I wanted to ask a question about one of the core principles of Islamic finance that you raised during your introduction, which is the opposition to speculation. One of the principles of the Austrian School of Economics, which we're very focused on in this podcast and Saferdin teaches, is that speculation is an unavoidable part of human action. Whenever someone undertakes an economic transaction, they're to a greater or lesser extent speculating on the outcome because outcomes are inherently uncertain. So what I wanted to ask you is, within the framework that you're using for Islamic banking, what is your definition of speculation? Is there a way that we can come up with a definite cutoff point for what's a normal market transaction and what's a speculation?
Right, okay. So if I begin, first of all, just very, very briefly in terms of the context in which speculation or gambling is prohibited. So in our religion, as I mentioned, the rules we are given in the context of 1500 years ago. So we are told that, for example, gambling, we're using bones and knuckles, you know, and dice. Gambling using those, throwing those and then paying money in the outcome is forbidden. Also, for example, pulling sticks and, you know, paying money on who's got the shortest stick. These kinds of things are forbidden, right? So then when we look at the world of finance and investment, I agree that it's, in many ways, you get circumstances where you put your capital somewhere and it's entirely uncertain what's going to be the outcome of that result, right? So, for example, if you're going into a startup, you raise money from investors, and these seed investors have no idea if they're going to get their money back or times 10 or zero. So that kind of speculation is acceptable because it's financial and there's full transparency, and you're relying effectively on the skill of the founders and their ability to earn profits for you. Now, that kind of speculation, in my view, it is permissible because it's finance and it's transparent, as long as you understand the risks, as long as you're not misrepresenting to someone and committing fraud. So there is a whole line in the middle. So, for example, if you speak to most Muslims, we would say going to a casino with something like roulette is not permissible, or poker. But even then, poker can be argued it's a game of skill, whereas roulette is a game of chance. So lottery tickets, for example, which are very popular everywhere, especially in the UK. So generally, most Muslims would say lottery tickets are not allowed. So I remember a couple of decades ago when we first had it in the UK, the lottery, one of the first winners in the UK was a Muslim guy, I think from Blackburn, and he won a lot, right? He's a rollover. He won quite a few million pounds. And there was some backlash because he's Muslim. His local community told him, you can't keep it. So he had to give the money back. So when it comes to financial markets with volatile price, I agree, it's not always easy to draw the distinction between the gambling side of speculation and legitimate financial speculation, because sometimes it's not clear.
So in the original definition of prohibitions, or the list of prohibitions you gave, you made a distinction between gambling and speculation. The reason that I asked the question about speculation is because, to me, the definition of gambling is clearer. It's a system where you have a set of rules and the odds for winning or losing are understood in advance. This kind of system exists within casinos, like spinning roulette wheels or playing the lottery, but this kind of system very, very rarely exists within the real world. So I guess the question would be, when it comes to investment, we would not call betting on a roulette wheel an investment, we call that gambling. But virtually any other kind of economic activity has to have some kind of element of speculation to it. So I was just wondering whether you could provide us with like a simple 1 to 2 sentence definition of just that term speculation and how that differs from the term gambling.
Okay, so maybe if I could provide an example. So let's say we have shares in whatever, in company X, and you're a legitimate investor and you want to buy those shares because you think, for whatever reason, the price is going to go up. Okay, so you buy those shares in a proper transaction. You're the legal and registered owner of those shares. You have full risk if the price goes up or down. Now, let's say on those shares, there are investors who want leverage exposure, who want to write options on those shares or contracts for difference on those shares. Now, that activity of writing those options and buying those options instead of the shares, that's probably where most Islamic jurists would draw the line. They would say buying those shares is okay because you're buying assets which represent ownership of the assets in the company, and you have full ownership and you take full risk of it going up or down. But if you're buying a derivative on those shares, whether it's an option or a future, for example, you're only buying an exposure to the price movement of those of that asset. You're not buying that asset. So, and of course, with options and futures, you can take highly leveraged exposure, but not have any economic connection with the activity of the company and its outcome, only with the share price. So that would be one indication where speculating on the prices of an equity through an option, purely with the aim to make profit or not, will be slightly seen slightly differently in Islamic law as to being a legitimate shareholder in the assets of that company.
Isn't the distinction, I could be wrong here, but isn't the distinction that when you buy something, you take custody of it? And whereas if you're buying something with debt or buying something without taking custody of it, then that's what counts as speculation.
So it also depends what you're taking custody of, because you can take custody of financial security. So, for example, you could take custody of options and swaps and derivatives.
But the option, you can't take custody of the underlying. So the difference between buying oil and buying an option, which says you buy oil or sell oil that you don't own, and you're engaging in all of these basically paper transactions where you're not going to actually take any oil.
Yeah. Okay. So I think there's a couple of points there. I think one is I think you're right. The further you get away from direct ownership, I think the closer you're probably going to go to speculation. And in terms of direct ownership, it's normally recommended, and it's often a part of the contract of sale. But in some assets, you can't always take a direct ownership if you buy property abroad, for example. But as much as possible, Islamic law encourages physical ownership. It says, if you can at all take physical ownership, you probably should, right? Because then that also helps to distinguish between a genuine transaction and a non-genuine transaction. That if you buy an asset that you never intend taking delivery of, whether it's possible or not, then that can create a question as to whether you really want to own that asset or whether you're just owning it for short-term speculation.
Yeah, and I don't think the physical custody is the important thing. I think it's just the ownership, the having unencumbered ownership. Like, this is my oil, I know it, I own it. Like, I think, if you buy the oil and you store it in you think that oil prices are going to go up next year. So you buy the oil and you store it in your warehouse and then you sell it next year. That's trading. That's no different than anybody buying or selling something. You expect that the price is going to be higher. But if you're just buying options, you're not the owner of the oil.
I think you're right, and it ties into if you're the owner of an asset, you must take full risk of ownership, right? If it gets stolen, you're the guy who loses. You're the guy who's got to pay insurance on it, right? Because if you take exposure on the price, but you don't have the obligation of an owner, then you're not really the owner of the asset.
Exactly, you're putting in the carry cost of the oil over the year, which would then make it a legitimate business activity. That next year you're going to sell the oil, are you going to cover your costs or not?
And this has an impact. When you write derivatives, for example, in the banking scene, at the last financial crisis, 2008, over a couple of years. If you look at some of the instruments in the shadow banking sector, so for example, we had direct loans between two counterparties in the investment banking space, and we had CDOs and CDSs written off those loans, which were instruments that were priced off the primary market. Now, the volume of those notionals in the shadow banking were up to 10, 20, and 30 times higher than the notional of the original contracts. Right, so if you follow what you were saying as well, if you write a derivative on an asset, you create a whole separate market that's really nothing to do with the underlying asset. And when something negative happens, not only the owner suffers, but you get 50 people waiting in line who've traded on the shadow markets that they hurt even more than the original owner. So for me, this is part of the wisdom in the prohibition of the speculation side of the markets.
Yeah, I think that's correct, and I think Peter's question is very astute, because it's a big problem in economics as well as, I guess, in Islamic finance, which is how to distinguish between people who think, you know, speculation is a bad idea, and it's also related to the, you know, how to distinguish between people making money being bad versus people making money being good. You know, what is it that makes one kind of money making good and one the other kind of money making bad? And I think in the Austrian sense of speculation, I don't, you know, when Austrians say speculation, they don't mean it in the way that, well, I think overall, the concept can be applied in the way that is forbidden in Islam. But I think in general, what they're referring to, in essence, is a natural market activity that would take place in an Islamic economy and any economy, which is any action you take is a speculation. You know, if you decide that you are going to cook at home today, that's a speculation that your meal is going to be better than the alternative, which is go to the restaurant.
Yeah, yeah. And I think part of this difficulty in understanding, and for me as well, because even though I understand some Arabic terms, but I'm not a native Arabic speaker. So the Arabic term for this is maysir, right? So say for you as an Arabic speaker, you might have a deep understanding of this for me. So when I come across these terms, I largely have to rely on the English translation. And the English translation is often speculation, which is a bit of it's an imprecise a translation of the original Arabic word we use.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. The words don't map exactly, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, this has been absolutely fascinating, Safdar. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for all of your comments. And this is, I would recommend for listeners also, we've also had another episode discussing this topic, well, similar concepts and topics to this, but I don't think there's a lot of repetition between the two. But with Haris Irfan on the podcast that you can find, I think it's episode 50 something or the other. So if you enjoyed this one, do check that one out, listeners. And thank you, Safdar, and thank you for everybody who joined.
Thank you very much, Saif, and thank you all your team for helping in the background to make sure it worked smoothly.
Cheers. Thanks a lot.